as a guest. Lightwoods, July 23rd, Tanya.
And then hopefully, if I'm successful, I do it. With God, the will and the execution are also simultaneously, meaning to say, things come into existence simultaneously as Hashem wills them. And this is unique to his mahus, to his essence, v'atzmuso. The mahus and atzmuso seem to be synonyms. They are references to the intrinsic nature of Hashem. B'tachlis hayichud, and there's a complete unity, and that's why between the will and the execution, there is no division at all. Now, v'ilu haisa hishtalshulis ha'olamais mi'orein saif barachu, belit simtsumim. Okay, let me backtrack a little bit. And again, when we get into this, the most I can really do is just introduce vocabulary, not necessarily penetrate into the total meaning of the concepts. But one of the very important terms that the Arizal introduced in the study of Kabbalah and the understanding of the mystic structure of the universe is a term, tzimtzum. Now, the word tzimtzum literally means contraction. And the Ari starts off with a question that is almost childlike in terms of its literalness, and that is, if Hashem is everywhere, then how can I exist, right? You can't have two things occupying the same space. God is everywhere, so where is there room for the table? Where is there room for me? Hashem is everywhere. So the Ari says, you're right. In order to make room for me, for the table, for the chair, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to contract within himself. Taking it very literally, Hashem had to bend over into himself. He made room, just like you have a crowded dining room table, right? So there's not enough room for everybody, so you got to squeeze in a little bit. So the Arizal introduces the idea of tzimtzum. Now, obviously, it would be ridiculous to take this in a literal way, because that would imply God is big and God had to contract himself. Yeah, it's not a body. So really, what tzimtzum means, it is indeed using a physical metaphor. And the physical metaphor is, there's no room, I got to make room. But what it really means is that in order for human beings to exercise free will and autonomy, there has to be, one cannot be totally aware of the essence of God. If I'm totally aware of God, then I cease to exist as an independent being. I become like a candle that is engulfed in the light of the sun. And that itself is just an approximation. And therefore, since it was Hashem's will that this world be based on free will and autonomy, and the reason for that is because goodness is only good if you choose it. If you have to be good, you're simply behaving as a computer or a Pavlovian dog. So by definition, goodness can be achieved only by the concealment of the divine light. Because if the divine light is ever present, free will and autonomy would automatically cease to exist. So Hashem makes a world of helem, a world, olam is concealment, a world of hiddenness, a world of concealment. And out of that concealment comes the capacity for choice. Out of that concealment comes the possibility of evil. Because after all, evil in many ways is a corollary of choice. Because otherwise you have like the old elections in the Soviet Union, in which you only had a choice of one. Well, a choice of one is not a choice. So in many ways, evil is a necessary evil, because it is the capacity to choose evil, which means that when good is chosen, it is an exercise of choice rather than something that's an involuntary thing. In fact, that even explains the idea of suffering. Imagine if you had a world where every time you did good, you got $1 million, and every time you did an avera, you got a shock. Well, at that point, we would tend to choose good because we were no better than Pavlovian dogs or rats or mice or pigeons or whatever it would be. So you almost have to have a world where sometimes evil pays off in the short run. Because when evil pays off in the short run, it becomes attractive. It becomes something in which I might gravitate, and then I have to make a moral choice to do the right thing, and then my goodness becomes virtuous. So in many, many ways, although the issue of why evildoers prosper is, you know, morally and emotionally a very perplexing issue, but one could understand this in part, again, I mean, intellectually understand this, by positing that you have to have a world where bad guys sometimes finish first and nice guys sometimes finish last, because that is the only framework in which bechira would be possible. Because otherwise we're just Skinner box pigeons or Pavlovian dogs, whatever psychological muscle you want to use. So the essence of this world, therefore, is definitionally one of symptom of contraction. So although the Arizal uses a very physical metaphor, God has to contract within himself to make room. But really, what you're talking about is a spiritual making room for human initiative, human autonomy, in which we exercise our capacity of choice, and only when there's choice is there virtue. There is no virtue in compulsion. Of course, let me point out that a lot of people have a definitional confusion here, and although it's actually a very simple point, but people say, wait a second here, how can God say there are punishments for Averos? Doesn't Hashem give me freedom of choice? So how can Hashem punish me for it? I mean, that's, again, I mean, the distinction there is the difference in English between can and shall, meaning to say, God indeed says to each person, you can do Averos. But that doesn't mean you're permitted to do it. In other words, the accountability is precisely because, since I'm given the power to do evil or not do evil, to do good or not do good, that is why Hashem can hold me accountable. Actually, it's the opposite. The truth of the matter is, the opposite would be the case. If I would have to do good because I wouldn't have the capacity of free will, then specifically I couldn't be punished or rewarded for it, right? So the fact that I have free will, which gives me the power to make certain decisions, does not mean Hashem is indifferent as to what decisions I make. In other words, people confuse free will is not the same as divine indifference to my choices. Obviously, a Jew does not believe Hashem is indifferent to our choices. If that would be the case, then there would be no such thing as the Torah. Right? What is the Torah other than telling me what the choices I'm supposed to make? But Hashem says, whether or not you'll make those choices is up to you. So the point of all this is just to illustrate that the Lurianic concept, the Ari's concept of Tzimtzum, is certainly not to be understood in a gross physical sense. It doesn't make sense on that level. But Tzimtzum is the mechanism by which God concealed his light so that we live in a state of grays instead of clarity. And in that area of confusion is where we exercise the capacity of choice. And choice is the most godly of all faculties, because only God really has choice. Animals don't have choice. They behave through instinct. Angels don't have choice. Although we have various midrashim where angels apparently make bad choices, but the simple idea of a malach is a malach does not have bechira. A malach is pre-programmed to have a certain function. So God is a free actor, and part of what it means that a human being is in the image of God, right? The Tzelem Elokim, there are a lot of different aspects of this, but one of the aspects of Tzelem Elokim is that man is a free agent to make those choices, that divine capacity of choice is a very, very significant component of the godly person, the capacity of choice. And again, psychologically, this has ramifications as well. Rabbeinu Yonah points out a beautiful thought. Rabbeinu Yonah points out in Shari Tshuva that, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Re'eh Enochi Nosein Lefneichem Hayom, behold, I put before you today the blessing and the curse. And later the Torah says, U'bacharta b'chayim v'zamaves, the life and death, u'bacharta b'chayim, you should choose life. Rabbeinu Yonah points out that the Torah's emphasis on the word hayom is very significant, because it reminds us that every single day we make new choices, and we shouldn't feel locked in because of the choices we made yesterday or the day before or last year. Right? It's human, you know, it's normal human psychology to figure, well, I've gone down a certain path for so long, that's where I am. I already made my choices, you know, 20 years ago. He says, no, every single day there's a new capacity for choice, and we're not locked in to the negativity of the past. Yeah.
Excuse me. Does this go along with the view that God can sort of know one's choices in advance?
Well,
How does that relate?
Of course, that's we've mentioned that a number of times. I mean, that's one of the most difficult questions. God's omniscience, God's knowledge of the future, how does that dovetail with human choice? And we talked about this, just mentioned quickly again. The Rambam tries to logically prove that this is an unanswerable question, and he says the following. He says, since God's knowledge is equivalent to God's essence, because in God there is no disunity. Unlike a human being where the faculty of knowledge is a separable entity from the rest of the personality, in God there is no division, and therefore any faculty of God is identical to the whole. So the Rambam says, therefore, if we don't understand God's totality, God's essence, we can't understand God's knowledge, and therefore how God's knowledge dovetails with human autonomy is considered to be an unanswerable question. Now, the Ravid, I mentioned last week, the Ravid is very upset at this. The Ravid writes that if the Rambam doesn't have an answer to this question, he shouldn't bring it up because it creates confusion for people who don't understand. But the Rambam is trying to create an Aristotelian syllogism that it's an impossible question. That's what he basically says. Others want to give a slightly different approach, which you could actually fit into the Rambam, and that is that the reason why God's knowledge is not a contradiction to free will is because God is not functioning in the realm of time, meaning the following. When you live under time where there's a past, present, and future, so if I'm in the present and I know what the future will be, that's a predetermined thing. That means by the time the future gets here, it's already known. And that would be a contradiction. You may remember the old Superman comics. I guess they still have Superman comics, where he was able to fly into the future, or fly into the past, and kind of change the past, you know, try to, and at the last minute something always happened, because you can't change the past. The past already happened. Well, if God knows the future, the same way. But if you say God is above time, then in a sense, although I'm going to use a time metaphor, in a sense, everything for God is the present moment. Now, here's the thing. If I see you doing something, I know what you're doing, but I in no way dictated your choice. I just see what you're doing. God's knowledge of the future is from the vantage point of the present moment. And therefore, just as a human being who sees the present moment is not dictating anybody's choice, he is just aware of the choice made. So if God is not in the framework of time, again, what I'm saying is not an accurate way of describing it, but God is seeing things from the present moment. And in that way, it's not a contradiction. The Ravid says something, though that's a little bit of a chiddush and a little bit of a difficulty. The Ravid says that God's knowledge of the future is in the realm of prediction, at a level of 100% accuracy. But it's still in the nature of prediction and not decree. The example would be, even with human beings, right? Your mother or your spouse might know with a very high level of accuracy what decision you're going to make, even though he or she is not mandating that decision. Since God knows us better than anyone could possibly know us, so God's knowledge of our choices is a predictive knowledge. It is not a coercive knowledge, so to speak. On the other hand, I have to say that although the Ravid is answering how God's knowledge does not interfere with free will, the Ravid is raising another question. The Ravid is raising the question that if indeed a complete knowledge of our past gives a 100% degree of accuracy for the future, then indeed, that itself means there's no free will, because every decision I make is the sum product of every decision I already made. That indeed was the claim of Dr. Watson, the psychologist, John Watson, where he actually said that if I knew a person's total history, if I knew his history totally, I could predict every decision they would make from that point on. So the Ravid is basically saying God has that knowledge of the past, which therefore he knows the choices of my future. So good. So God's knowledge doesn't interfere with my choice. But if you're telling me my future choices are inevitable as a result of my past, then you have even a more fundamental question about the reality of free will. Now, obviously, that doesn't kick in until a certain point. I don't think Watson said that the first thing you did as a newborn baby dictates the whole course of your life. But at some point, he learned that certain forces are set into motion that are deterministic. We believe not that way. So all I'm saying is that this is a difficult question, but there's no question that Bechira is a very, very fundamental principle. So the Arizal, in Kabbalistic terms, says that Bechira emanates from the concept of Tzimtzum, because had the light of God not been contracted and concealed, I could not function with independence. I would be figuratively blinded and submerged in the essence of godliness, and I could no longer function as an autonomous being. And that's what the Baal HaTanya says. Again, this is really elaborating on what the Ari writes. And he says, if the Hishtalshulus, if the development of the worlds would have been without Tzimtzum, without contraction and concealment, Keseder HaMadregos, Madrega LaMadrega, it would simply move from cause and effect. Lo Haya HaOlam HaZeh Nivra Klal, Kamo Shehu Ata. This physical world would not exist at all. Bibachinas Gavul V'Tachlis, it could not exist as a physical entity. How could physical entities, as it were, exist in the total presence of unlimited godliness? Mea Aretz L'Rakia, right? This world has a Gavul. We measure from the ground to the sky. Mahalech Tav Kuf Shana. Again, the Gemara gives different numbers. It says, from the earth, imagine if you had to take a walk. So from the earth to the sky is a distance of 500 years, if you'd be walking, and whatever the distance. It's giving, in metaphoric terms, the huge distances of the universe. But whatever those distances are, they are finite on some level. There are seven heavens. Between each heaven is a distance of 500 years. V'chovi kol rakia, and each heaven itself is a mahalich of 500 years. V'afilu olam haba v'gan eden ha'elyon, and even the spiritual worlds of olam haba, mader neshamas atzadikim, the chambers of the righteous, hagdolim, and neshamas atzman, the souls, ein tzarich lomar malachim, even malachim, angels, are bebechinas gavul, they are limited, tachlis, they have an end, so to speak. Ki yesh gavul lahasagasan biyor ein sof. There is a limit to what even malachim perceive. That's why we have levels of angels, right? We have seraphim, ofanim, chayos hakodesh, arelim, right? The Rambam says, based on Tanakh, that there are 10 different terms that are used for the angels in Shemayim, and they represent different levels of perception of the divine. That even the highest angel only perceives a limited aspect of the divine. And that's why there's a gavul lahana asan. There's a limit to the, lahana means the pleasure they get from connecting to Hashem. Shenanin mizif hashchina, umisangim bior Hashem. Ki ein yecholin, they are finite. They cannot be makabel the hana of the tainug from the Ein Sof Mamish, because if that would happen, Shelo Yispaklu Mitziusa, their whole independence would cease, the Yachsaru in the Koran, and they would be submerged in the Or Ein Sof, in the infinite light of Hashem. So by definition, this world can exist only through the concept of Tzimtzum and concealment. Now again, do you see how this relates to the overall thesis? Meaning to say, if we live in a world where the divine is concealed, we don't always feel connected to Hashem. That is exactly how the world was created. And it is our job to create that feeling of connection. In other words, it's not a sign of failure. If a person feels the disconnect, that is exactly the nature of the world and the tzimtzum that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created. Now, what the Arizal then does, again, the symptom as a concept is just a concept, but the Arizal continues the metaphor to a very, very extreme way. The Ari quantifies how many tzimtzumim occur. And all of this is in a very grossly physical way. And the particular parts, kavyachal, of the Godhead that contract, etc. And volumes and volumes and volumes. And all of this, it says, is a mashal. In fact, one of the reasons why historically people were warned not to study Kabbalah till they were 40, until they knew Shas, until they were married, and all sorts of rules about who would study Kabbalah, was precisely because of the fear that if one takes the writings of the Arizal in too much of a literal way, one has a physical and a corporeal view of God, because so much of the Ari's writings are describing, you know, as if Chas v'Shalom HaKadosh Baruch Hu had bodies, and you're talking about this contraction, but all of it is a mushel for spiritual realities. So it's hard enough to get the mushel down. The mushel is almost incomprehensible, and but then to understand the beyond the mushel is beyond us. So here the Baal HaTanya writes, he's not going to go into this. He says, Pratiyos HaTzimtzumim, the actual content of the contractions that God went through to create this physical world, eich u'ma, how they happened and what happened, ein kan makom biurim, this is not the place I'm going to talk about this. Because here, once again, if you remember, the Tanya was written to be a practical guide of spiritual instruction for people who felt depressed and felt disconnected, and they wanted to have a passion in their avodas Hashem. So he says, for that important purpose, we don't have to go into all the details of the pratim of tzimtzum. Ach derech klalheng, but as a general proposition, bechinas hester vehelem, they involve progressive levels of concealment and hiding. Hamshachas or v'achias shelo yoyer v'yumshach l'tachtonim, as it were, from the orein seif, as it goes down and down to eventually culminate in the physical, there is more and more light that is being hidden, withheld, concealed. Hashem is holding things back with filters. Shelo yo'ir v'yumshach l'tachtonim, that different parts of the Orein Seif does not enlighten and get extended to the lower worlds, bebechinas giloy, in an open way, lehislabesh ulahashpia, to become enveloped and to influence, ulahachayosam, and to give them life, yesh me'ayin, right? Yesh me'ayin is something from utter nothingness. Ki im ma'at masir, it is only a tiny little bit of the or, of the light, and the chias, and the life force, and that enables the concept of finiteness. In fact, the Baal HaTanya doesn't say it this way, but some Mekubalim say it in an interesting way. You know, we describe, in fact, he just described it, we describe the process of creation as yesh me'ayin. Something emerges from nothingness, total nothingness. Right? There is nothing, and Hashem's light creates something. But some want to say that the process of tzimtzum is actually the opposite. You start off with the ultimate something, and it generates a nothingness, because what happens is the following. The Orein Sof is the totality of reality. And if Hashem is mitzamtzim, his or, so there is physicality and finiteness, that is really an ayin. That is a nothingness, because that eventually disintegrates. So the true process of creation is not that Hashem brings something out of nothing, but rather that which is nothing emerges out of the ultimate something. So instead of describing Bria as a yesh me'ayin, it is an ayin me'yesh, because the yeshus of Hashem contracts till it's almost a nothingness, so to speak. And that allows the little residue, allows the physicality and finiteness of the world to come into being. And he points out that this is ha'ara mu'etes mi'ait. This is a very infinitesimally small light of Hashem that allows for physicality and finiteness. Umamish kalo chashivi. It is as if it's almost non-existent. Legabe bechinas ha'ora b'li gavul v'tachlis, as compared to the infinite light That is the essence of God. V'ein b'neihem erech v'yachas klal. And there is literally no point of comparison between the or that is mechayei physicality versus the ultimate essence of God. K'neida perish milas erech b'misparayim she'echad b'mispar yesh lo erech. He's pointing out that when you have numbers, you know, there is a relationship even between one and a trillion. Because, you know, you have enough ones, they add up to a trillion. But there is no possible relationship between a number and infinity. Infinity is not just a large number. Infinity is beyond numbers. So he says the erech, the comparison, so to speak, is not between a trillion and one. Rather, it is from infinity to numbers, meaning to say there is no erech, there is no point of comparison at all. She'echad b'mispar, the number one, yesh lo erech legabe mispar elef alafim, it has a value to a million, to a thousand thousands, to a million, shu chelek echad. Yeah, I guess in those days a million was a big number. Now with Obama budgets, we talk about trillions, so, you know, we use bigger numbers. But the concept is still the same. Shu chelek echad minei elef alafim. One is one out of a million, right? One has a relationship to a million. Aval lagabe davashu b'chinas b'li gavul mispar klal. But something that is infinite, ain connecto, shum erech b'misparim shafilu elef alfei alafim. Right? Millions, trillions, billions is still a nothing with respect to the infinite. Ain anafilu ki erech mispar echad lagabe elef. That is the tiny bit of light which creates this entire... Remember, we're not talking about the light of one person. The light of the... That brings to life the whole physical universe is compared to the Or Ein Sof, like one to an infinity. Hamislabeshes biolamas el yainim v'tachteyum lashpia b'hem l'achayosam l'gabi erech or haganuz v'nelam. But the hidden and concealed light, which is b'chinas ein sof, eino mislabesh u'mashpia, it does not envelop itself and influence in the olamas in an open way, l'achayosam, elamakul. Actually, he's introducing another term here, a very, very interesting explanation. You know, and He's mentioned this phrase a number of times. It's from the Zohar, that Hashem is described in two ways. He is described as Sovev Kol Almin. He surrounds all the worlds. Umimale Kol Almin. And he fills all the worlds. Right? Sovev Kol Almin. Umimale Kol Almin. Now, some want to give a psychological meaning for this. Some want to interpret this, in fact, this is a sharply debated by some modern writers on this, that they want to say that this refers to the two ways we relate to Hashem, which the fancy theological terms are immanence and transcendence. Right? So immanence is that sense of closeness to Hashem. The camaraderie, the friendship, the love that we have with Hashem. That's called immanence. And that refers to mamale kalaman. God fills me up. God is within me. I feel that God is part of me. Sovev is the other aspect of Hashem, that he is transcendent and he is beyond human comprehension. And one might say, based on this, that mamale kol almin is the feeling of love of Hashem, which actually ties into the idea that there's this hidden love within the heart. Sovev kol almin, the transcendence of God, is the element of yira, of reverence and fear that one has for the Almighty. So there's the or panimi, the inner light, which is the source of love. And then there's the sense of God beyond me, that the whole universe is located, so to speak, within Hashem, which means he's totally beyond the universe, and that generates awe and reverence. I mentioned before the beautiful comment of Rav David Avudraham, one of the early Achronim, maybe late Rishonim. I mean, the Beis Yosef quotes the Avudraham. There were actually, just as a digression, there actually is a lot of uncertainty. You know, we have Rishonim, we have Achronim. Right? We have the early authorities. There's actually a lot of uncertainty. When do the Achronim begin, exactly? So some actually say that the writing of the Shulchan Aruch was considered to be the beginning of the Achronim. So even the contemporaries of Rav Yosef Karo are sometimes, like the Mabit, Mamarit, are sometimes classified as Rishonim. There are others who want to posit, although it's not clear what the clear nafkamina is going to be, but others who want to posit that the Shulchan Aruch and a few generations afterwards is an intermediate period between Rishonim and Achronim that are called Kovim. Kovim are those who set down halacha as a code. So they want to create Kovim. Others say Kovim is a fiction. Such a period was not recognized. So be it as it may, the Avudram is earlier than the Beis Yosef, so it's not. It's not a big nafkamina. I mean, you know, if you accept the rule, it's not even clear that this is a rule, that an Acharon cannot argue with a Rishon. If you accept those as rules, so the assignment of periods becomes significant. But the truth of the matter is, these are absolutely not. You know, we learn in yeshiva something like this. You know, almost like it's a rule. An Acharon cannot argue with a Rishon unless he's the Vilna Gaon. That's what that's kind of a rule that we're taught. Like, you know, what type of rule is that exactly? There's really no such rule. But realistically, there was an understanding among the Chachmei HaTorah that there was a very steep decline, and therefore they understood that they had to approach the opinions of their predecessors with a great deal of reverence. But it's not like a rule, so to speak. In fact, Rav Chaim actually says, there's not even a rule that you can't argue with the Gemara, he says, but it's a rule of probability. He says, what's the probability that I got it right and an Amora got it wrong? It is zero, basically zero. So, but he says, there's no halacha principle, so to speak. It's interesting. It's just a question of knowing your limits and knowing who you are. Even the rule that an Amora doesn't argue with the Tana, he says, is not a rule. It is based on a sense of Yerida Severus. But be it as it may, the Avudram is quoted by Rav Yosef Karo in the Beis Yosef, and the Avudram points out, I mentioned it before, that brachos switch in grammar from second person to third person. Baruch atah, blessed art you, Hashem, shakol liya bidvaro, everything came into existence through his word. So it should say, shakol liya bidvarecha. So the Avudram says, this, in every bracha, we encapsulate these two elements of connecting to Hashem. The nochach, you, is a relationship of closeness, friendship, love. And the nistar, the hidden, the third party, reminds us of distance and boundaries. Havas Hashem, which is closeness. Yiras Hashem, which are boundaries. So, some want to say that psychologically and spiritually, that might be the meaning of this important phrase from the Zohar, that Hashem is mamale kol almin and sovev kol almin. That the mamale kol almin represents the feeling of closeness to Hashem. He is within me and I feel his presence, which is one of friendship and love. And sovev is Hashem is beyond me, enveloping the totality of this universe, which is one of yira. So, as I say, the immanence and transcendence. The Mamale Kol Almin is said to be the immanence of Hashem, and the Sovev Kol Almin is the transcendence. The Baal HaTanya, well, again, it might be ultimately he actually is making the same point, but he expresses it in a different way. The Baal HaTanya says that Mamale Kol Almin is that minute portion of the Or Ein Sof that is actually mislabesh betachtonim. In other words, what you have is this. You have this Or Ein Sof that contracts and dilutes itself till finally it comes in a little bit into this physical world and generates it. So that little infinitesimally small light of Hashem, which generates finiteness and physicality, is called the Mamale Kol Almin. But the great Or from which the Mamale Kol Almin comes from is called the Sovev. So he says, Sovev Kol Almin is the indirect hashpa of the infinite, and the Mamale Kol Almin is the direct hashpa of that tiny fraction that is allowed to directly function in this world. You see, in other words, what he's saying is, that tiny little infinitesimally small fraction is the thing that is directly functioning in this world, coming from the contractions of the ore that is sovev, that is infinite. So he says the sovev is a reference to the infinite light, which is the source, and the mamale is that aspect of godliness that is allowed to be revealed in this lowly world, which is only the tiniest of the little sparks. Again, I mean, you might be able to apply the immanence and transcendence to that dichotomy as well, meaning to say the immanence is that part of God that I can access. I shouldn't even say that part of God, but the aspect of divinity that I can access, the sovev, is the part that is infinite and therefore incapable of me having any direct connection to. And that's what he says. He says, V'kacha mamish, b'chinas ha'ore mu'etesu, this little bit of light, hamisla beshes, that is dressed within these physical olamas, the olyanim and tachtainim, lashpia bohem, to influence them, lahachayosam, to give them light, lagabe erech or hagodas, compared to the hidden light, v'nelam, shubi b'chinas ein sof, the Eino Mislabesh, right? That Ein Sof is not enveloped directly into the physical. It, as it were, surrounds them. Milmala. And that is the meaning of Sovev, Kol Alma. By the way, he uses the phrase Or HaGonis. I'm not sure if he means to bring up a Medrash. Now, Rashi brings this Medrash as well. That it says that, you know, the sun was not created until the fourth day of creation. And yet every single day of creation, right, the first day of creation, Hashem said, Or, Yehi Or, Yehi Or, and there was creation for day, there was light on day one, day two, and day three. And what was that light? So the Medrash says this was the light of the Shekhinah, that's the lesson that it uses, which Hashem hid away for the Tzaddikim, when the sun was created, and that light is called the Or HaGonus, the hidden light, which is the same term that he's using here. And in fact, the Mekubalim say a wondrous thing. If you look at the Hanukkah candles, so the Hanukkah candles, we Paskin like Beis Hillel, right? They're not counting the Shamash, that you have to light an extra candle every day, or at least you should light a candle every day. So the total number of Hanukkah candles per menorah is 36. So there are 36 Hanukkah candles, 1 to 8. So he says that represents the 36 hours that the concealed light of Hashem functioned in the world. And that light was taken away from us. But spiritually, the light of the Hanukkah candles are the 36 Or HaGonis. 36 candles represent 36 hours of the Or HaGonis. Although, once again, a Hanukkah candle doesn't have to burn an hour, but whatever it is, the number 36 corresponds to that. So that's why among Hasidim in particular, there's a great mitzvah to sit by the Neiros and gaze at the candles, because one is absorbing, as it were, some aspect of the infinite light of Hashem that is normally withheld from the world, but somehow we get it in some concentrated form.
The 36 hours mean 3 days?
Yes, yes. There was no Or HaGonis. The night was night, so there was no Or HaGonis. And in other words, there were 36 hours for the first 3 days of creation in which God's hidden light gave light to the world. The night there was no Or HaGonis that night. Okay. But again, I'm not sure if when he mentions Or HaGonis, he is referring specifically to the Medrash that talks about that Or HaGonis. Okay, now he explains, what does it mean? So this is an important definition here. What is the meaning of sovev kol almin, that God surrounds the worlds? Ein ha-perish sovev u-makif mil-mala be-bechinas makom chas v'shalom. It certainly does not refer to the geographical location of Hashem. Ki lo shayach klal be-bechinas makom beruchnias. This is what he says. There is no such thing as place in spirituality. You can't even say God is here, God is there, etc. God is everywhere, as the song goes. Ela rotzolomar, sovev umakif milmala Le'inyan b'chinas giloy hashpa'a. In other words, the revelation of the godliness that creates life. So there is a little spark that comes into us, but the source of it is outside of us because we're not able to be makabel that. Ki hashpa shu b'chinas giloy b'yalamas. The influences that achieve a revelation in this world, that is called halbasha, right? This is a phrase the Baal Tan uses a lot. The ruchnius is enveloped, is dressed in the physicality. That's mamale kol almin. Shemislabeshas b'yalamas kiheim malbishim umasigim. Again, what he says is the following. You know, just like when we say, you know, you wrap, here's a phrase we use even in English, you wrap your mind around something. When you understand something, you wrap your mind about it. So in a sense, you could look at the idea as being mislabished. The idea is dressed up in my brain. So he says, again, he's using these metaphors, so he says, that aspect of godliness that I could perceive is called the godliness that is mislabesh in my seichel. And that is called mamale kol almin. But that aspect of godliness that is infinite and therefore not capable of allowing me to function as an autonomous being and would not be capable of generating a world of physicality and finiteness, that's the opposite. That is not, right, I don't wrap my mind around it. That is beyond me. And that is what is called a sovev. Ma she'en kein ha'hashpa, she'en ha'b'b'chinas gilo, yale behester ve'helem, ein ha'olamas masigen osa. The worlds cannot wrap their mind around it. That is not called mislabeshes. Therefore, it is not dressed in my mind. Ela makefes. It surrounds me or surrounds the universe. Visoveves. Hilkach. Me'achar. Sha'ilama ishem bebechinas gevul v'tachlis. Since this world is physical and finite, nimtza she'ein hashpas or ein saif. Mislabesh u'miskala bebechinas giloi. Therefore, it is not enveloped and it is not revealable in an open way. Rak, once again, ma'at mishar, tiny, tiny little bit. Ha'ora mu'etes mitzumtzemes ma'od ma'od. K'dei l'hachayosam, because you need some divine spark to give it life. Bibigova tachlis. Aval ikar ha'or, belit simsum kolkach, but the Iker, the root of God's light, without such a contraction. He says kolkach because even the or hamakif is a contraction. But that primary source of or is called makif v'seivev. Me'acher. So those two words are interchangeable. I mean, they mean the same thing, although there must probably be a technical difference. Makif, sovev, surrounds. Me'acher she'ein hashpa'aso. Actually, they say there's even a remez there. They bring down what was that? But by a talis. It's interesting. They have this thing. In fact, Enoch Chabad has a whole thing among their rebbes, where when do you put your talis on your head? When don't you put your talis on your head? I mean, I don't understand it myself, but they say that the first kisei, the yarmulke, represents the mamale kol almin. That's the light of God that is within me. And covering your head with the talis is the or hamakif. And they have all sorts of rules and procedures that at certain times of tefillah, you have to be makasher yourself to the or hamakif. And other times, you know, you bedafka, take off the talis because you're not supposed to be makusher to the or hamakif. So they have different aspects of this. But that's why it is brought down among the mekubalim. That even though you have a talis over your head, why do you need a yarmulke? They say, Alpi Kabbalah, you have to have b'shas tefillah, shnei kisuyin. In fact, that's even one of the reasons for wearing a hat. You know, the often criticized black hat phenomenon. So why do you wear a hat? So the litvisher reason for wearing a hat, which some have argued shouldn't apply today, is that since when you daven Shemona Esrei, you have to be the way you'd go to see a melech, So in Europe, at least, again, that's why people say, in Europe, you know, when you would go to see an important person until JFK, even in America, you may take off your hat, but you'd wear your hat to come to the royal audience. It was a sign of respect, even among goyim. So if the concept of covering your head is because you're omed lifnei hamelech, that would be the union of a hat. Now, in truth, if that would be the reason, it would be difficult to see why there should be such a concept today, because today it's very uncommon. In fact, only yeshiva bachurim and blacks buy hats today. I mean, there is no. I mean, the average person men do not wear hats today. It's not a common thing, and that is why you find that among the Hester yeshivas, you know, the Israeli minog is not only don't you wear a hat, but you know, even on Shabbos, just wear a white shirt. And again, yesh lahem makom lismach, because if the chiyuv of all of this dressing is because you have to behave the way you are when you're omid lifnei hamelech, so where you're less formal. Of course, even then though, I mean, the truth is when you see, at least wear a jacket, because most people when they go see the president would wear a jacket. But al pi Kabbalah. The inyan of wearing a hat is that b'shas tefillah you have to have two kisuyim, not just a hat, a yarmulke and a hat, because one is keneged the or of memali kol alman, and the other is keneged the or hamakif. So that would be the same reason of covering a talis and wearing a hat. So that would be a separate inyan. Now there's a third explanation for the talis or for the hat, and that is. The question of whether a yarmulke is big enough, you know, standard, you know, maybe the requirement of kisui requires the whole head be covered. So that would depend on the size of the yarmulke. There are, you know, yarmulkes that are big enough. Yeah.
Could focusing on these distinctions between or soviv and or mali, couldn't that lead to I guess confusion or problems about yichud Hashem if a person focuses on these distinctions?
No. There's no question that. These can sometimes lead a person astray, and obviously Hashem is a total yichud, an undifferentiated yichud. However, our ability to perceive, just like you know, Lahavdol, you know the famous children's tale about the seven blind men and the elephant. So each person perceives only an aspect of it. Rav Moshe Cordovero even describes the spheres this way. We talk about Chesed, Gevura, these different spheres. So the mashal he uses is the spheres are like colored glasses. So if you take water, you pour it in a red glass, you see red. You pour it in a blue glass, you see blue. So we perceive God in different ways, but that does not detract from the unity itself. So all of this is mitzad our perception. It's not going in the essence of things. So he says, v'amashal b'zeh. And now he gives an example. Hine ha'aretz halazu hagashmius, this physical and material land. Af shemale kol aretz kvodo, right? God fills the earth, the world, with His glory, and that's the or ein seif baruch hu. Halo, as Hashem said, halo as Hashem v'zart nimale. Right? Behold, I fill the heaven and the earth. Af al pichein, ein mislabesh bitocha. Bebechinas giloy hashpa, right? The Or Ein Sof does not actually, as it were, enter and become enveloped in this physicality, because otherwise physicality wouldn't exist with the total revelation of the life. Rak chiyus ma'at miser bebechinas domein v'tzuech. Again, going back to the idea that matter itself has multiple levels. You have the domain, which is the inanimate, right? This goes back to medieval. Domain is the inanimate, like rocks. You have the tzomeach, the vegetative. You have the chai, the animal. And then you have the medaber, the speaker, which is the human being. And these have different neshamas. Rocks have souls too. Because what is a soul other than the life force from God that allows it to exist? Now, granted, we would not say a rock has life, but a rock has existence. And if a rock has existence, there is some spark of God within that rock that is giving it existence. But qualitatively, there is a greater revelation of the presence of God as you ascend to higher and higher levels. So there is the domain, there's the tzomeach, there's the chai, there's the medaber. The Kusari, by the way, says that there is a fifth level, and that is Yisrael. It's very, very interesting. He says that the same way that you have a difference between the chai and the medaber, he says you have the difference between the medaber and the Yisrael. Right? This is the Kusari's overall idea, which the Bala Tanya subscribes to, by and large, that the Jewish neshama is qualitatively a different neshama. It is a different spiritual entity. Those who are critical or negative will describe this as racist, as sometimes people do attack the Bala Tanya and the Kusari. I've mentioned before that in the Rambam's writings, I believe, again, I can't say for sure, I believe in the Rambam's writings you do not find that type of discussion. The Rambam does not seem to describe the Jewish soul as a qualitatively different entity. The Rambam is more pragmatic in that sense, less metaphysical. The Rambam says Jewish people have different obligations for which Hashem will reward them, but the soul is not an existentially different chefza. But Chassidus and the Kuzari much earlier, the Kuzari was before the Rambam, actually talks about the Jewish soul as a totally different Metzias. It is a different Metzias. And this, of course, is the basis of the Chassidish emphasis on the Pintli Yid, meaning to say, even if a Jew doesn't keep mitzvahs, that's a very bad thing, but there's still something special, because the Jewish soul itself is a different entity. The Rambam might not agree to the same extent. The Rambam says, you are what you do. You live a life of virtue. You're a holy person. You don't live a life of virtue, you're not so great. In other words, it's a different thing, as opposed to the metaphysical idea that the Jewish soul is a totally different entity. Now here the Bala Tanya doesn't say that. The Bala Tanya just says that the level of godliness, he only mentions four levels. There's a domain, Someach, Chai, Medaber. And he says, 1 second. V'chol or ein seif, nikra sovev olaha. And the infinite light is called the sovev, even though there is part of that light that is betocha mamish, meyachar shein hashpa'aso miskalis. But it's not open and revealed to its fullest extent. But it's mashpia, it's influencing it through hester, concealment, helam, hiddenness, and a hashpa that is coming in a hidden and concealed way is called a makif. It surrounds me, milmala, and this is the meaning of another phrase that is called alma diiskasya. There is the world that is concealed, and there is the world that is revealed. And like an iceberg, which only reveals the tip, so too, the godliness that is revealed in the world is infinitesimally small as compared to the godliness that is hidden and not revealed in the world. The alma diiskasya, the world that is concealed, or the universe, or the existence that is concealed, is lamala bimadrega mealma diiskalya. And now he's going to say, ulekarev el haseichel yoser, and to maybe understand this intellectually a little better, he wants to give a mashal, another parable. Kamo ha'adam shemitzayir b'dayta eza davar shiro shiraya. Let's assume I want to take a picture in my mind of something that I saw or that I am seeing presently. In other words, I want to remember what this tape recorder looks like. Hine. Af shekol guf etzem adavar ahu v'gabo v'tocho v'toch tocho kulo mitzuyer b'dayte. Even if I have an absolutely perfect photographic memory, so to speak, so every single detail of this thing is now in my mind. I can imagine exactly what it looks like. Shero kulo, I saw all of it. O shero'eo, I see it right now. So that is called my mind is makefes, right? I wrapped my mind around the idea, right? My mind has enveloped the tape recorder, or another way of saying it is, the tape recorder, at least the idea of the tape recorder, is mislabesh, is dressed up, as it were, in my mind. Hadavar ahu mukaf b'dayto machshavto, but that is only a metaphor, that's not literal. Because I can say my mind is surrounding the tape recorder, but that's only the picture of the tape recorder. That's not the tape recorder itself. The tape recorder is not in my head. So to say that the davar is mukaf in my seichel is only a mashal for the idea of the thing. Eino mukaf b'payo mamish, rak b'dimyain, avol HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When we say Hashem is a sovev, that God's mind envelops reality, it is not just the idea of reality, it is the physical reality itself, as it were, is mukaf in Hashem seichel. As the pasuk says, literally, lo machshavosai kemachshavoseichem. Right? This is the Haftorah we recite on every fast day. That